right, so Duncan wanted us to, or at least wanted me to, present essentially what we learned from GW 1708-17 about the nuclear equation of state, but try to basically phrase it in a kind of a provocative way. Let's see, you know, if we really have any means of saying by, let's say, with not 100% certainty, but at least, you know, to a very, very high degree, that we actually have constrained the nuclear equation of state, and we're confident in what we're saying. So that's going to be the theme, essentially, of this particular talk. Of course, I don't need to convince you. We have this gravitational wave measurement of this object that I'm going to say it's a compact binary with at least one neutron star. And even I actually consider having a neutron, actually a question mark in front of the neutron, because I wasn't, you know, you'll see why I'm saying that later on in this talk. So, but at the same time, apart from the gravitational waves, we had the wonderful gamma ray burst, or is it a gamma ray burst? That's also another thing in the literature that doesn't seem to be precisely at least settled on yet. I think we all believe that there was a kilonova that we found, and Brian and collaborators and others essentially have done some wonderful job essentially trying to model this event. So the basic idea is that a successful binary compact object model must explain all these observations, or just turning this around, the observations can constrain the parameter space of all the available models that we have. So that's what we're going to be discussing here. So here are some open questions that I just put down on this slide. I think one of the things that are not settled yet, was it a binary neutron star or was it a black hole neutron star? And if we have the black hole neutron star scenario, what are the constraints that we can place on the equation of state in that scenario? Now, if we assume that it is a binary neutron star, how strong are the constraints from the gravitational waves alone? What was the fate of the remnant? What are the constraints from a joint gravitational wave electromagnetic observations perspective? And how do hybrid hadron quark equations of state modify this story that I'll try to touch a little bit upon, because I've done a little bit of work with my students as well on this particular aspect. So let's just try to go to review some work that has been done on the first question. What are the constraints? Sorry, what was it, a black hole neutron star instead of a binary neutron star? So there's this nice paper by Hinderer et al. Who actually performed a joint gravitational wave electromagnetic observations analysis. This basic, the top plot shows the just the gravitational waves alone. This is the phase difference from the gravitational waves as a function of frequency. Looking at variable, different scenarios. It's a binary neutron stars, essentially the orange, blue dashed, and cyan dashed dotted curve with different equations of state. The black dashed curve is the black hole binary, and this red one, the solid red, is actually a black hole neutron star binary with the same equation of state. So the basic idea here is that this is all the phase difference with respect to the binary black hole. That's why that's zero down here for the binary black hole. But the basic idea is that if you just look at gravitational waves alone, even though the DDT equation is marginally, as a binary neutron star, marginally compatible with GW 1708-17, if you actually have a black hole neutron star, then the phase difference becomes lower, and it goes into the regime where other equations of state are actually compatible with this particular event. So at least from the gravitational waves alone, we cannot really tell the difference between a black hole neutron star and a binary neutron star in this case.
What are you assuming for the object masses?
Yes, good question. So this is actually assumes that we have, that this has been done by doing an actual parameter estimation from the gravitational wave data. The only assumption that is made is that the black hole is heavier than the neutron star. So these, this particular red curve goes corresponds to a mass ratio of 1.2:1, for example, but for the black hole. So the only assumption that goes is that, I don't know why, but the black hole was considered to be heavier than the neutron star. If you go into a black hole neutron star regime, I don't necessarily understand why you need to assume that the black hole has to be heavier from the neutron star.
And that black hole would be less than 2 solar masses.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Then we go into a question about of how do you form such a low mass black hole, but then I'll just respond by saying, how do you form a 30 solar mass black hole, which is not spinning? So if we want to keep, you know, so if we want to stay, you know, at least without outside of our biases because of, you know, astrophysics that we already know, and just be completely agnostic on what's out there, I think that's a fair point to make.
Is the fact that it could be a neutron star black hole something to do with this system, or is that just in general with the systems in this mass range, you can't tell?
You cannot tell. Okay. Yeah. It will be, unless we actually have much higher sensitivity at larger frequencies where we can actually see the deviations in the gravitational waves, I think it's going to be very difficult to tell the differences. And I'll mention a few more things about this scenario.
I mean, just to be clear,
yes.
The observation of a two solar mass black hole is a major.
Yeah, sure. It would be a major. I mean, I think even in the mass gap, actually, it would be a major discovery. It doesn't necessarily have to be a sub two solar mass. But you know, there are scenarios out there.
To have the measured black hole less than a measured neutron star.
But I mean, I think there's a difference between like a 30 solar mass black hole, which means we don't understand stellar wind physics. A mass gap black hole, which means you don't understand supernova. There's a distinction between that and saying I can form a black hole that's less than, you know.
Well, I mean, there are scenarios. We can have primordial. We can have primordial black holes that are in that range, right? So you know, if we go, well, I mean, I don't think it's a matter, you know, that somebody
it just
should
means,
be.
Like, it's a different categories of.
I totally agree, and then you know possible. we go into well.
Okay, no plus, but how,
you know. We can all argue, you know, ourselves to death. I think, you know, that if we want to maintain an agnostic view on things and let's just wait for the observations to tell us what's really happening out there, I think that's a fair point to make.
I would say the other way around, which is that 79SMT wasn't loud enough to conclusively say it wasn't a black hole neutron star, rather than it suggests that it could be a black hole neutron star.
Yeah. I mean, that's and that's also the spirit that this paper is written. Essentially, it just says that it is compatible. And the other thing that they're looking at, it's not just only the gravitational waves, but also what they do is that from the parameter estimation, essentially, they put in the compactness that they find, the mass ratio, and the spin of the black hole that is compatible with the gravitational waves, and then try to model what's out there as a remnant matter around the black hole that forms after the merger. And what this thing shows here is the posterior distribution for the mass ratio versus the remnant matter that's outside the neutron star. And so if you put this 0.1 solar mass, which seems to be the favored thing if you want to explain the kilonovae essentially, then essentially all this part of the parameter space is allowed. And so what they conclude is that if you just do the percentage analysis, about 40% of the gravitational wave parameters are actually compatible with the electromagnetic wave observations in this particular scenario.
Well, I mean, this doesn't consider, right, the color, the whole issue of composition and lighting, which is an issue to explain.
I agree with you. They didn't go into that detail, but it's not entirely clear to me that this cannot be explained. I think there's more that needs to be done to say for sure that you can actually rule that out. But they certainly don't touch up at this point. So, again, you know, trying to be agnostic, if GW170817 is a black hole neutron star, then any constraints that have been published in the literature that constrain the maximum mass of a TOV star, they're not applicable. Also, the same applies to constraints on the radius that come from the threshold mass from prone collapse to a black hole, if you have a black binary neutron star scenario in that case. These will become more clear as I go through this talk. And what they were able to do essentially is that they were able to place some weak constraints on the neutron star radius again by combining the electromagnetic and gravitational wave observations. And basically the neutron star radii essentially are in this range. So it's about from 11 to 15 kilometers roughly in this parameter space, at least for black hole neutron star binaries. So it doesn't seem to constrain the radius of a neutron star as strongly if you assume that is a black hole neutron star scenario.
So can I ask something that's maybe also
yes.
productive, which is, you know, in terms of putting a lower limit on the radius from the gravity, I mean, it seems counterintuitive to me that you can put a lower limit, that you could say, okay, and distinguish, in other words, a 10-kilometer radius from an 8-kilometer radius.
This is not just from the gravitational waves. This accounts for the fact that you need to have matter outside the black hole, right? So so if you have too low compactness a star, then you're not going to be disrupting it, and then essentially you're going to have a tiny amount of matter, so you cannot explain the electromagnetic observations.
And the quote best lower limits on radius come from the EM side, but there's controversy there.
Right.
Okay.
Right. All right, so that's regarding the black hole neutron star scenario. So now if we assume that it is a binary neutron star, how strong are the constraints on the equation of state from the gravitational waves alone? I'm just going to put here Duncan's slide. I actually wanted to provoke him, but we had a chat yesterday. so he, I'm looking forward to his talk. So this is a slide from Duncan's presentation at the APS meeting this year. So it's basically, this plot is trying to answer the question, does GW170817 favor a binary neutron star over a binary black hole? If you just do pure modal selection, do you actually see that the gravitational waves...
And now you're just assuming gravitational waves.
This is just gravitational waves, yes, exactly. So, of course, Duncan is far more... qualified to explain this plot than I am. The basic idea essentially is that this is the base factor down here, the ratio of the base factors, right?
This plot's kind of confusing. This plot shows the it's how we compute the base factor. It's average log likelihood versus temperature in the Markov chain Monte Carlo, and the area under
both
curves.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And so the ratio of the area under both curves is the base factor.
Okay.
So the base factor here is 0.26.
All right. So this is the troublesome aspect, essentially, from this plot. is that you cannot really favor binary neutron stars over binary black holes just by focusing on gravitational waves alone. So, that is one important aspect. Of course, Duncan is going to tell us tomorrow, I guess, that there's a little bit more to this story. But at least one question that one can ask, if modal selection does not favor binary neutron star over a binary black hole, how can we trust essentially the tidal deformability constraints from gravitational waves alone? That's not something that you can actually say with any high degree of confidence. And then the most important aspect is how strong are the constraints, the EOS constraints from gravitational waves alone, and Duncan is going to tell us more about it tomorrow. So that's all I'm going to say about this aspect. Now, what was the fate of the remnant? I think a lot of studies have been done to argue what the fate of the remnant is, but I think there's room for a lot, for at least a couple of possibilities. And I'll go through the basic arguments essentially by showing you this diagram. So we have the binary neutron stars. They merge, and then we ask the question, what is the fate of the remnant? The total mass of the binary is what primarily is going to determine what's going to happen after the merger. Decades of numerical relativity simulations have demonstrated that there is a threshold mass, that if the total mass of the binary is greater than this threshold mass, you get prompt black hole formation. If the mass is less than the threshold mass, the total mass of the binary, then you have a couple of possibilities. It's not going to be a perfect picture from this point on, and I'll mention a few things about this. But roughly speaking, if the total mass is less than what we call the supermassive limit is the maximum mass that can be supported when you allow for maximal uniform rotation. Okay? So take a star, spin it up uniformly. How much mass can you possibly support on such a uniformly rotating star? That's what we call the supermassive limit. So if you're less than that, you're going to form what is called a supermassive neutron star, which can stay there and survive for quite a bit of time. And if you're sufficiently low mass, you could actually have an indefinitely stable star. If the total mass is less than the maximum mass of a non-rotating star, for example, then you can actually have a completely stable configuration after some time. Now, in the opposite regime, if the total mass is greater than the supermassive limit, then you're going to undergo what is called delayed collapse to a black hole. First, you're going to form what we call a hypermassive neutron star. So we have more mass than the supermassive limit. This has to be rotating differentially to be able to support more mass than the uniform rotation. And this collapses later on a secular timescale, whatever essentially is the main viscous dissipation, essentially mechanism, whether that is magnetic fields or you know, neutrinos that can carry away essentially angular momentum from the remnant, everything that essentially is going to drain angular momentum, and we're going to have a black hole with a torus that's going to lead to a jet. That's at least the basic idea. Yes?
A differential in latitude or radius or both?
That's a very good question. So, but you know, primarily if we're talking about irrotational neutron stars that roughly do not spin, then all the angular momentum is going to be essentially the orbital angular momentum. So the object that's going to form is only going to be differential rotating with respect essentially to the distance from the axis of rotation. So that's the basic idea. If you have spin and you have misaligned spins, then the story is going to be a little bit different. At least, you know, temporarily you can have some meridional currents as well that are flowing at the same time, not just toroidal. But for the most part, you know, people would believe that neutron stars are not spinning, but I'll talk about that as well. So so that's the basic idea. And any other questions? All right, so that's the basic idea. And so the arguments that have been made to rule out, or at least some arguments essentially that have been made to rule out some of these scenarios are the following. So prompt collapse, turns out that numerical relativity simulations have demonstrated that you have very little mass left outside the black hole remnant. So you get too little ejecta, you basically wouldn't be able to explain the kilonova that followed 170817. In addition, another aspect is that if you don't really have a hypermassive neutron star phase that doesn't lead to magnetic field amplification, and in conjunction with a very tiny disk that you form outside the black hole, you basically cannot, at least simulations have not been able to demonstrate that there are at least some form of jet structure that can arise from this scenario. So it doesn't seem to be compatible with 170817. That's just one argument.
Can I just ask, is there a simple explanation for why that boundary between it collapsing and not is, makes such a big difference in terms of how much stuff is ejected? Like, we're not, right, a kilonova, my understanding is, right, we're not seeing the compact object, we're seeing all the junk around it.
Right.
And it's not clear.
I guess one way to think about it is that in order to collapse, it has to remove angular momentum from itself, I mean, to redistribute it. In other words, you know, in the case of the prompt collapse, it just immediately collapses. And,
yes.
And in the other case, it has to redistribute the angular momentum in order to collapse.
Right.
And since you, when you redistribute angular momentum, you redistribute mass, so you're kind of pushing mass outside.
That's right.
So a lot of the ejecta comes from after the merger.
Yes.
Emergence.
Yes. Yeah. So that, as Brian has actually demonstrated that, I mean, if you look at numerical relativity simulations, you just focus only on the dynamical ejecta during the merger. These are a tiny fraction of what's necessary to explain the kilonova. So Brian actually and collaborators have worked on what happens to essentially the disk that stays outside the black hole or a neutron star essentially, and how that can actually lead to winds that you can then, you know, have much, much more mass essentially in a, ejected from the system. And then you can explain the kilonova signatures.
So then do things like deformability impact that amount of matter?
Yes, it does. I'll get to that.
It's not tidally stripped.
Yeah, I'll get to that. There is I have things to discuss about that as well. So this leads to at least a plausible constraint in that if we don't want to allow for the prompt collapse scenario, then the total mass of the total mass of the binary has to be less than this threshold mass for prompt collapse of the black hole. So that's one constraint. Now let's go the other.
There's a constraint on the spin of the remnant as well, right? It's just the total mass, or is that? Or is it just you get enough mass within the limit and the whole thing collapses? There's no.
It depends on what your assumptions are initially. So if you have purely irrotational binary neutron stars, right, you let them merge, then there's a unique value per equation of state.
Right.
That leads to this prompt collapse. Right. If you wanted to have your stars spinning, as I mentioned, actually, this will make a difference.
And I assume purposefully vague on these thresholds and masses and things, and I assume that's because they're not extremely well known exactly where they're
actually quite well known.
Oh.
Yeah, to within like, I would say 0.05 solar masses, these thresholds are fairly accurate.
They're EOS dependent.
They're EOS dependent, but there is a universal relation that has been discovered, and I'll mention that as well. So now the other branch, if we have the total mass less than the threshold mass, then we're going to go in this, if we go the other scenario, essentially where the total mass is greater than the supermassive limit, we have a hypermassive neutron star. This leads to the right amount of ejecta from the dynamical perspective to ask to at least explain some aspect of the kilonova. And then from the remaining matter outside, you can also explain some other aspects of the kilonova, as Brian and collaborators have demonstrated. In addition, this scenario, my collaborators and I have demonstrated that you can actually achieve at least some kind of an incipient jet that arises from these kinds of mergers. And so you can also explain a potential GRB-like signature from these kinds of events. So this seems to be a compatible picture. This is just advertising my work, so I'm just going to skip that. So it is a compatible scenario. Now, the other branch, where we have the total mass less than the threshold mass, essentially we have the total mass less than the supermassive limit, then we're going to form a star that's going to stay there for maybe hundreds of seconds or thousands of seconds or even indefinitely. One of the very nice arguments that have been made essentially by Ben and Brian is that energetically, and I guess Ben is going to talk about this tomorrow, right? So energetically, this is actually quite disfavored as a scenario. Another point that the thing is a little bit also contributing to that was made in this paper, there's no extended emission after the gamma ray burst, extended X-ray emission. So observationally is also disfavored, not just only from a theoretical perspective. In addition, there is a work in progress that we have right now where we actually cannot even form, if we were to assume that we have a supermassive neutron, we cannot get any kind of a jet launching from these kinds of scenarios right now. At least it doesn't seem to be favored. So it's likely incompatible. There is some work by Pierre et al. That argues that it may be possible. I think one of the main arguments essentially is that the spin down in the remnant is actually coming from gravitational torques, not from magnetic torques. And that requires some kind of a, let's say, a little bit far-fetched magnetic field configurations to actually explain the ellipticities that arise in the binary neutron star merger remnant in order to make it compatible. Even from an energetical point of view. But there's an idea out there, at least. All right, so this seems to be the likely scenario that a lot of people favor. We have total mass less than the threshold mass and total mass greater than the supermassive limit, and we have this delayed collapse scenario. So let's focus on the first constraint that I mentioned, is the total mass is greater than the supermassive limit. Sorry, the second constraint. And what are the constraints now that we can set on the equation of state if we combine these gravitational wave and electromagnetic measurements? Actually, that slide was misleading. So the first constraint is that we want the total mass to be less than the threshold mass for prompt collapse. So this is the slide I mentioned to you, Duncan. There was a paper by Bauswan, Baumgard, and Janka in 2013 that basically studied this threshold mass for prompt collapse for different equations of state. So what they did, they performed multiple binary neutron star simulations, changing the equation of state, which means changing the compactness, that is for a given mass. And then what they plotted is this ratio of K, which is the ratio of threshold mass to collapse, divided by the maximum mass that a TOV star, a non-rotating star, can support, versus the compactness of the maximum mass configuration, which is M max divided by the radius of the maximum mass configuration, or what they call the compactness of a 1.6 solar mass neutron star, which actually is a little bit misleading because it's not the the mass of a 1.6 solar mass neutron star, but it's the maximum mass divided by the radius of a 1.6 solar mass neutron star. And so what they found is that there's this nice correlation in all these different simulations. So the correlation can be written in this particular way, that the threshold mass is proportional to this C1.6, essentially, or this K ratio is proportional to this C1.6, or you can also express it as proportionality relation with respect to the Cmax that is defined here.
In the sense,
yes.
How robust is this?
It's quite robust. So excuse me.
Where are the error bars?
Oh, the error bars. They're
systematic error bars.
When you say, well, systematic is a little bit.
Physics are not included in this relationship.
Right. So we don't expect magnetic fields to have any impact on this, because you don't have enough time to amplify them to make them to be important. Neutrinos are also not expected to make any have a strong impact on this, and that's because you don't really have time to heat anything. Everything collapses so fast that everything would actually be immediately going to the black hole. So it's fairly thermal physics is important. You have the right thermal part of your equation of state. Not just take any random, essentially, hybrid approaches that we've been taking in numerical relativity, but if you take I should have pointed out that this is with realistic finite temperature equations of state. So it's not with just other equations of state where people typically just say that the equation of state is going to be some cold equation of state, pressure plus this hybrid approach, which is going to be this gamma thermal minus 1 rho naught epsilon. So this is not what they do. They have a finite temperature equation of state for that.
Now, how many equations of state do they look at?
Well, each one of those dots is the
equation
of state.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're drawing a line through that.
Oh,
right.
That gives you a sense of the spread.
Right.
Okay, so let me try and understand this. So I pick an equation of state that gives me a maximum mass of the neutron star.
Precisely.
The equation of state and the radius of 1.6 solar mass.
And then you know what the threshold mass is. Precisely.
So what this is saying is that the collapse threshold varies between 30% and 60% above the maximum mass.
That's right.
Depending on the compactness.
That's correct.
More compact, star will collapse
faster. At a lower K.
More compact one will be 30% above, the less compact one will be 60%.
Right. But it's not, but it's actually this nice linear relation between, essentially, these two. Physics that is not included is full general relativity in the speculation. There was a recent paper by... It assumes the conformal flatness approximation. So essentially, throughout the binary, evolution is essentially gamma ij is delta ij times a conformal factor to the fourth power. So, but it's not that bad. So there's a paper that was published recently by the Frankfurt group, Luciano Rizzolo's group, who redid this calculation, including full general relativity. Basically, it agrees to within a few percent with this result. So the relation holds. What they report is that it's not exactly linear, that maybe there's some quadratic, essentially, corrections to this. But the basic,
we can draw a sine wave.
I think it's the basic result is the same. It doesn't really change.
So why? Like, what's the theoretical understanding for why this relation holds?
Oh, there's actually, I don't remember the full argument, but we can get back to that. There's a nice argument that Thomas actually made in this paper based on polytropic equations of state that demonstrates why essentially this happens, but I don't remember it off the top of my head. But there is a qualitative way to understand it.
There's also, I don't remember the details, but there's a nice paper by Andy Gosselin and
Nick Sargulis,
who went through sort of the same analytic derivation of this type of relation with the equilibrium models. But I forget
the exact details. Yeah, the only I think with that paper, it's like if you consider differential rotating stars, you're assuming your particular differential rotation, and it's not clear to me how things change if you change the differential rotation law. But I guess the qualitative aspect, it does apply.
I think the other question is what, and I think they addressed it to some extent, but what is the spread with the mass ratio in those two, right?
It's a good question. In fact, it's so for a long time, people believed that it doesn't make a big difference with mass ratio. There was, in the paper that I'm going to be discussing, essentially, this idea, about how constraining the radius. What they did for this particular work, they actually ran more simulations with a different mass ratio, and they find that what the mass ratio does is actually lowers the threshold mass for collapse. And so essentially, this is a stringent constraint, so essentially then if you consider different mass ratios. That's one of the things. So if you go to the equal, I should have also mentioned that. This is also for equal mass black binary neutron stars, not unequal masses.
So the claim is this is relatively robust to mass ratio.
Yes. Well, no. It actually does depend. It doesn't have a strong dependence on the mass ratio, given that the mass ratio is not going to be wild, you know. So, but let's say between 0.7 and 1 or something like that, it's fairly robust. It does have an impact. But the thing is that this threshold mass that you get from the equal mass case is actually larger than what you would get, essentially.
So if you're using it as to put a lower limit on the radius.
Precise.
If you use the equal mass one, it's kind of the most
extreme. Right. It's very similar to the LFP relations, right? So it's a surface, and if you extend the surface like into the board, then you would get the variability with a symmetric mass ratio.
Correct.
And so this is like tilted like that with a small slope.
Right. Right.
So there is a bit of a definition problem here, which I think.
I completely agree with this.
What is exactly a prompt collapse? Because there was this recent paper by Ken Takeuchi.
Which I'm going to go through that as well. I'm going to mention that as well. And also, I was going to mention this idea, what you just said.
Just a simple question. So anything looks special about a 1.6?
No, there's nothing special. They just chose it there. Maybe they tried different values, but they found the best correlation, I think, with 1.6. But they don't mention... They don't mention that why it's 1.6, but my guess is I probably tried a couple of different values and found that 1.6 gives a better correlation. That's my guess.
For GW1708, does this suggest a lower limit to the maximum mass?
No, it only suggests a lower limit to the radius, and I'll get to that in the next slide. So you have now these expressions, which are the universal expressions. And another thing you can do, so what we said is that the threshold mass for collapse now has to be, in order to be able to avoid essentially the prompt collapse scenario, the threshold mass for collapse needs to be greater than the total mass of GW170817, which essentially it has to be roughly greater than 2.7 solar masses. That's the basic idea. You know, you might add another digit, you know, maybe here, but you may actually remove it because there's a little bit of uncertainty. There's also matter that is being ejected from the system, and you know what actually happens in the end. It's not. It's of order going to be.
And also, the posteriors on M1 and M2 are quite wide.
That's so a different story.
But the total mass is relatively constrained.
If you focus on irrotational neutron stars, actually the range is very tight. It's not that large. But it's true that if you have spin, this doesn't really have any serious constraints.
So it's huge degenerates.
I agree.
Well, there's big degenerates in individual masses, but actually the total mass is.
So if you go down to the mass ratio
No. If you consider neutron star spin, the total mass of the binary can have a very large range. So then you're going to have to say, you know, I'm going to assume that the stars were now spinning. You know, that's a prior that you're putting in your analysis, and you know, if we maintain the agnostic point of view, and I'll get to that, I have a slide on that as well.
But we know that neutrons are spin, right?
But and that's a good point.
But I think we assume slowly.
Even you know, one of the points that I'll make later on is that essentially, since this is actually a threshold calculation, that's an important thing to keep in mind. Even if you have a spin of 0.05, it's going to change the threshold mass. It's not going to be the same. It could actually change it by a little bit such that you actually have a bounce instead of and then you generate heating, essentially, from this. I think these calculations should be taken with at least, you know, some caution. You know, I wouldn't say that they're the final word. We need to run more simulations to be able to make more constraints. But the idea, I think, is a wonderful idea. So let me just explain what goes on here. So we have this expression, let's just focus on the left one, where we find the correlation between M threshold and this C1.6. So you can, now we have to combine it with the idea that the threshold mass for collapse has to be greater than the total mass of the binary, which is roughly 2.7 solar masses. Now there's also an empirical relation that has been found, is that the maximum mass has to be roughly less than R1.6 divided by 3.1, and that's all in geometrized units. And so what you can do next is you can actually try to make a plot of this as follows. For a given value of a radius, you can actually vary the maximum mass of a T of E star. And then this relation tells you what is the threshold mass for from collapse. So this is what this plot is doing. So we have these curves, essentially are a particular radius for a 1.6 solar mass neutron star. And so by varying the maximum mass, we essentially get this, we can populate this entire plot. Now, this constraint essentially limits this area, so that it has to be above this line here. And this constraint limits essentially the plot only in this area. And so as a result, if you are looking for the what is the last essentially neutron star radius on this plot going from top to bottom that is compatible with this particular area is really a R of 1.6 of about 10.6 kilometers, whatever, given the uncertainties. So the number they put essentially is that the radius of a 1.6 solar mass neutron star should be greater than 10.6 kilometers.
And total plan comes from the 1708-17 LIGO paper?
Sorry, what?
They have the horizontal band model and focal.
Oh, this. Yeah. This is the uncertainty essentially for the total mass. Yes.
So where does the Mmax come from?
Mmax, it doesn't come from, you vary.
No, the Mmax much less than R1.
Oh, this is by just studying T of E stars, essentially, and with multiple different equations of state.
Like the causality?
No, the causality is actually here. So if you want to focus on the maximum possible mass configuration, this is where the causality is. Is that if the maximum mass, that it has to be less than the maximum radius.
I believe that's the causality argument for the maximally stiff equation of state, and that's the causality argument for realistic equation of states, which whatever that means. They examined some batch of equation of states and saw that empirically, if you don't take the maximally stiff one, that goes into empirical causality.
Is it causality? I don't remember.
It can't be causality, right? So causality states the speed of sound coming from the speed of light instead of right?
Above a certain density.
Not sure.
Right. So you trust your nuclear equation of state up to a certain density, and then right. You say, I'm going to match it onto a maximally stiff equation of state beyond that.
Oh, that's right.
Right. Nice. So that's the basic idea. All right. And so you apply the same thing then for the other relation, and you find that the radius of the maximum mass configuration essentially has to be greater than 9.6 kilometers. But that's the basic argument, which is a beautiful argument. I really like it. It has a lot of assumptions, however. Then we have the constraint from GW170817 that the total mass has to be greater than the supermassive limit. This was also, I think, used to some extent by you guys as well, not in the way that I'm going to say here, but at least.
It's the same argument.
Yeah. We allow it to go into this. Supermassive, but you don't get very far before you see practically.
Well, the difference between what you did and what was done in Rizzo et al. And Sola et al. Is that you don't particularly choose a 1.2 value essentially for this relation. You actually just study equations of state and see if they're compatible with, which is a little bit better than what people have done before. So what was done in Rizzo et al. And Rizzola et al. Is they took this equation, which says that the supermassive limit, the maximum mass that you can support when you have maximal uniform rotation, is about 20% larger than the maximum mass of a non-spinning star. And this seems to be quite a universal statement when you focus on hadronic equations of state. And so by taking this number and taking the other constraint that I mentioned, that the supermassive limit has to be less than the total mass of the binary, then this sets a constraint on the maximum mass of a non-spinning star, which is the total mass divided by 1.2, which is roughly 2.3 solar masses. So that's another constraint that has been placed. So now we can go to our favorite plot, mass versus radius. This area here is excluded essentially by causality and other things, but essentially this box here is excluded by the radius measurement of the maximum mass configuration, that it has to be greater than this 9.6 kilometers that I mentioned. This area is excluded by the measurement of the 1.6 solar mass neutron star, and that was about 10.6 kilometers, so this is the area that is only allowed. And now, if we focus on the maximum mass constraint, essentially this 2.3 solar masses and up is excluded from this plot, so that's how you can actually place constraints on this MR plot.
It's actually less than 2.3 because you have to account for the binding energy.
It's ballpark. I'm not going through the careful, but you're right. I mean, and also you need to account for other things that.
What's it purple?
It's the uncertainty essentially provided by the total mass, essentially uncertainty that you have from the measurement. Now, there's another idea that was put forth that goes back to, I don't remember who mentioned it, Chris, I think. You mentioned about the tidal deformability essentially of the star, how that enters. So Radice et al., what they considered was they did a bunch of equal mass irrotational binary neutron star simulations that undergo black hole collapse to within 10 to 20 milliseconds after merger. And what they did was to plot the total mass outside the black hole, which is disk mass plus any unbound material, versus this binary tidal deformability for the binary neutron star. And so what they found is that if you make a requirement that the total ejecta that you need for to explain AT2017 GFO, which is the kilonova, essentially for 170817, then this sets essentially this limit on how much mass you should have outside the black hole. And as a result, just by eyeballing this plot, essentially this sets a lower limit on the tidal deformability, the binary tidal deformability, which is about 400. So that's the argument that was made.
What is that measure? What is that quantity, tidal deformability?
It's a long expression.
This is where we want to say that this is, I think, a really bad way to phrase this constraint, because it's not, I mean, essentially this break here is just the prompt collapse threshold of Bell's point. I mean, it's basically the same threshold, right? I mean, more or less.
Well, the point is here, so the really confusing thing about this plot is that, right, this is putting a constraint on 1728-17, but the simulations of all of these different points on this plot aren't simulations with masses that fit 1728-17. They're just a random batch of simulations that were done previously. And so what really changes this lambda tilde is mostly, well, there's two things, right? It's the mass of the system, and it's the radius of the neutron star equation of state, which is the way we typically think of tidal deformability as a proxy of radius. That's only true if you fix the mass, if you know the mass or the chirp mass very well.
Right.
If you change the mass, which is really what's happening here, then it's completely different physics. It's not really the radius that's affecting this, rather it's whether or not you have enough mass to promptly collapse or not. So it goes back to this.
So this is really just the prompt collapse limit. That's what I would say.
But that's essentially what causes this cliff
in the simulation. So I don't see, to me, I don't see it being a different constraint.
Within, you're right, that within the equal mass regime, essentially, you're absolutely right about what you're saying.
The tidal deformability is a constant proportionality that tells you, if you have a star that's immersed in an external field, how much will it deform in response to that external field? And so there's a variety of deformabilities because you can do a multipolar expansion. So this is the dominant one is what's called the quadrupolar deformation, right, and it's of electric parity. So it's electric quadrupole deformability. This lambda tilde is a particular special combination of the deformability of one star, the deformability of the other star, and the two masses of the stars that enters at leading post-Newtonian order in the phase of the waveform, which is what I hope people can measure like really well, as far less well. Not well at all.
I think you said it right. It's not well at all.
So that's what that quantity is. And it has nothing, at least, that it gets excited sort of in the late-in spiral, like when you have the two stars and they're close to each other. And the reason is, you know, one of the stars now, if it fills the field from the other, has to get deformed, that eats some of the binding energy and affects the amount of time it takes for the spiral to actually proceed and the merger to happen.
And the spiral was quantifying not all at all. So if lambda tilde is very large, right, then you have six neutron stars, large neutron stars, and you have a lot of energy that is dumped
out
of the formability. And so that causes it to spiral more quickly.
Right.
And so it shifts the gravitational wave phase evolution. And the bigger lambda tilde is, the bigger the shift in the phase evolution. Now the problem is, this is a, we know the evolution of the point particle piece of the waveform up to 3.5 post-Newtonian order, so seven corrections beyond the leading order. This is a 5pm effect, so it comes in a higher post-Newtonian order than the corrections we know, but it has a big factor in front of it, so it's a large effect. But it's, you know, large is relatively speaking, right? This is really a small sector effect that accumulates over the course of the interval. It becomes large near the end of it. So each post-Newtonian order is the power of B over C. And so the higher post-Newtonian order, the higher post-Newtonian order, the faster the thing has to be moving to get a noticeable effect. So this is a relatively small effect, right? This is not a huge effect on the waveform, like varying the masses or something. But small effects can build up over many, many cycles and give you a big phase shift. So if you have big lambdas, it is fairly well measurable, I'm not convinced. But as lambda gets smaller, it gets smaller and smaller effect, and gets less and less measurable.
So yeah, I think, are you going to show the plot?
So I can show that plot, yeah.
Tomorrow, well anyways, yeah, so in the paper with Michael Coughlin, we actually took David's simulations, and instead of plotting it versus lambda, just plotted it versus the total mass divided by the threshold mass for that equation of state.
And you get the same.
And it actually gets, the constraint gets tighter, in other words, you know. So I think the way to interpret it is that, you know, we have a total mass, you know, measured from LIGO, and this is, I mean, essentially I read this as, I mean, basically that prompt collapse threshold depends on the radius of the neutron star. Right. Radius is what is coming into the lambda. So
that tells me there's a better way to put this into the gravitational wave results than what David did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Plus, there's more, you know, that can be said. I mean, there's. I'll get to. All right. So, something that I've looked at a little bit is how do hybrid hadron quark equations of state modify the story that we've seen so far?
If I could interrupt you. We're talking in terms of maximum mass. We can also think of delay time to collapse.
Mm-hmm.
And so presumably there are lower limits and upper limits on the delay time to collapse. And my question is, what are those?
That's a good question. You know, everybody throws out 1.7 seconds.
It could either be much shorter than that.
It could be shorter than that.
But nobody's really done, I mean, We didn't see the merger in LIGO, right? That thing disappeared into the noise. So any time of merger predictions from LIGO are a waveform dependent statement. And so we need to look at the systematics of that. And then, you know, then there's a question of, you know, well, it's based on the GRB time, right?
Well, there's the GRB time, and it could be that, I mean, the delay of the GRB. Part of the delay could be the fact that it took a while to form the black hole and make the jet, but a lot of it could be that it just takes a while for the jet to get out of this environment. So I think it's hard for us to actually say.
Absolutely.
So I think we can say the collapse, if we think a black hole is a requirement for a GRB and for the jet we saw, then you can say the collapse had to happen less than 1.7 seconds.
Right.
But I think the other thing is that's harder to extract is the colors of the kilonova, and if you can infer how, you know, because when the neutron star is present, it's a strong source of neutrinos, and that can change the YE of the ejecta, and that can change how blue or red the kilonova is. So we've tried to look at this with Rodrigo and then with Jonas Lippener to try to quantify the electron fraction distribution as a function of the lifetime of the central neutrino source, i.e. that's the lifetime of the neutron star. But it's a tricky game, but it seems like it would be hard, based on those calculations, to get any lanthanides out in the disk wind if the neutron star survived for like a second. So my personal bias is that the thing survived for less than a few hundred milliseconds, but I don't think we can say
definitively
that.
Right.
And
I think another way that if you just want to focus on that plot, like David's plot, and just want to focus on the mass as a function of some parameter instead of the title from building think of time scale, then the time scale there are extremely short. It's basically a couple milliseconds.
Yeah.
But any more than that, you just get a lot of mass, and any less than that, you don't get.
But I guess the other thing, though, is
maybe.
The other thing I would say is that I think theoretically we have no real handle. Maybe you could dispute this, but I would say we don't really know exactly what and how efficient the process of angular momentum transport is in the remnant. So I don't think we can say theoretically, like if we knew this thing survived for 300 milliseconds, I don't think we're going to be able to tie that back to the simulations, because it all depends on what are the magnetic stresses inside this thing, and we don't have any handle.
And it's not just the magnetic stresses. There's a the paper that appeared by Shibata 3-4 days ago or something like that essentially does point out that the neutrinos also carry away a significant amount of angular momentum from the remnant. I'm happy to hear your opinion. I mean, I didn't read it, thoroughly, so I don't know but the main argument essentially has to do with the fact that you have a lot of sources that dissipate essentially angular momentum. If you account for all of these, essentially you may actually end up collapsing, not, for example, with angular momentum that is actually not greater than the Kepler limit. And in which case, several of the arguments, in particular this particular argument, does not apply anymore, because you don't really have the angular momentum to support a supermassive neutron star anymore. But there's a lot of arguments that have been made in the literature, so I'm just giving an overview essentially here. That's I'm not defending necessarily a particular calculation. I'm just laying it out here for us to have a discussion, and then we can just debate ourselves to death. All right. So it turns out that with a couple of nuclear theorists from Europe, David Blaschke and Armin Sederkan, Ken Yagi, and myself, we actually looked at David Alvarez.
So it's also.
Yes.
You're going to present these results now. So before you start, do you or does anybody know what the status of this hybrid hadron quark star quark material stars is? Do we think, or do the nuclear physicists think, that these are equally likely as purely hadronic?
If a hadron quark hybrid star has an equation of state similar to a hadron star, then it's perfectly fine.
Yeah, I don't think it can be ruled out. Even from experiments, it cannot be ruled out. And so for example, one of the arguments that were made in the paper that we wrote is that the transition where we actually go from, and these equations of state that I'm going to be discussing, that we go from hadronic to quark matter was actually quite low. But then there are calculations, not calculations, experiments that demonstrate that where you actually have the phase transition does depend on the axial spin asymmetry essentially that you have. So it all depends on how symmetric the matter is. It's still an open issue. It's not something that has been settled.
Sure, but just because you can't rule it out doesn't mean that there isn't a strong theoretical bias in favor of it.
So there's an important point. If you measure the equation of state, so mass and radius, that doesn't tell you the composition.
Right. That's right.
So you can have a quark equation of state that gives the same mass and radius.
Yeah.
As a nuclear.
And regarding the question you're asking, I would say it would depend on what nuclear physicist you're asking.
So there's no consensus.
Based on the discussions with the biased nuclear physicists that I've discussed, there's no consensus. But I don't know. Maybe Chuck has a different point of view.
But I think there's a consensus that nobody believes strange quark stars are real. I think that's
that
the
true?
First statement.
Right? I don't know.
We haven't found positive.
Like MIT bug model type.
Yeah, I mean, being self-bound by a lot is unlikely.
Right. So that's not the situation here at all.
No, that's a different. That's a little bit different. It's not the same.
Well, I know that.
It doesn't.
In the center of a two-solar mass neutron star, are there quarks or are there hadrons? That's a very interesting question, but it's very difficult
to answer. Right.
Related to observables.
Yeah. I mean, it's a plausible, theoretically plausible, essentially, idea. So let me just, for if you haven't heard of hybrid quark hadron stars, essentially before, or the so-called the third family of compact objects. So essentially, these are scenarios where you have an equation of state that has of this form, pressure versus energy density. We actually have a phase transition where the pressure is constant here along the phase transition. And the jump over which essentially the density remains constant is what dictates whether you're going to have a third family of compact objects or not. And by third family of compact objects, basically is shown better here. If you have the small jump, as is demonstrated here, then essentially this would be the mass radius curve that you would get. But if you have a large jump, what happens is that you would have the neutron star branch here in the mass radius plot, but then you would actually have a third family of compact objects that arise. These are going to be essentially these hybrid quark hadronic neutron stars. And if I were to plot it as a function of energy density, you would actually see that this area here is actually the unstable branch of hybrid stars, and this would be the stable branch of hybrid stars. And this would be the maximum mass of what we would call essentially the third family. So this would be the third family of stars. And the range of masses where we have stable stars in the third family that are the same as those in the stable stars in the neutron star family, they're called twin stars, if you've heard that before.
So twin stars and hybrid stars are very different concepts.
In terms of...
Oh, I mean, you can perfectly well have hybrid stars without...
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes. Yeah, you need to actually have this overlap here to have twin stars, essentially, that have the same mass range, essentially, with neutron stars to be able to have this.
I never heard of this terminology. Could you repeat again what the definition of a twin star is?
Yes. So in the cases where we can actually have a third family of compact objects, there will be a range of masses where this particular range, which are stable stars in the third family, that have the same mass as the stable neutron stars in this family here. So these stars that are in the third family and have the same mass as the neutron stars are called twin stars. So the difference is that, you know, you could view it, you know, it's very interesting because, you know, if you were to do a mass central density plot, I mean, we would have stable white dwarfs, right? Unstable white dwarfs. And we have stable neutron stars, unstable neutron stars. And then here, the idea is that you have stable third family stars and unstable, essentially. So essentially, on this plot, it becomes more clear is that this area in neutron stars and this area in the third family, these are what we would call the twin stars.
They have the same mass but different radius.
Exactly.
But Chuck, you're saying you don't have to get twin stars with hybrid stars. It just depends on the
That's
star.
That's right. You can have a second order phase transition.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're talking about a first order phase transition with a large jump.
Right.
Even if you have the first order phase transition, unless you have a large jump, you're not going to have twin stars. So right. For example, here we have a first order phase transition, but there are no twin stars here.
But I mean, they have the same mass, different radii, different. I mean, one of them has a minimum energy, right? So there must be some time scale for transforming from one to the other. What did you think?
Time scale from going from a white dwarf to a neutron star.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So. Okay. I understand if you really expect both of these. I mean, they're dynamically stable situations.
Well, I.
Both of them to be stable on secular timescales, or I don't know, longer. Really, misinterpreting. Like you're gonna.
Well, it depends on the mass that you start out with, right? So I think it. And also, you know, it turns out it would depend on what is the. Because that's another important thing. It would depend on what is the maximum mass of the neutron stars and what is the maximum mass of the third family. So if your maximum mass of the neutron stars turns out to be lower than that and you have a maximum mass of your progenitor that is above that, then you're actually energetically favored to go to the twin stars, or the hybrid stars. Now, whether you're going to go down to the twin star regime, it's not entirely clear to me whether you could actually, if you're essentially here and here. I don't know what would be dynamically favorable in that case. But it certainly is true that you can have, for example, here it's quite clear that the maximum mass of the neutron stars is not as high as that of the hybrid stars. So if you had a progenitor such that you were in a range that the maximum, that the mass of the remnant would be here, then you would probably end up on the hybrid stars, on the third family, not on the neutron star branch.
I'm super confused. I mean, if those two things are both stable,
yes,
then you would need some sort of like fairly strong perturbation to take you away from one minima to another.
If you are here, you're right. Yeah. But that's what I'm saying. But if I have a progenitor whose mass is such that the remnant that I'm forming is above the maximum mass of the neutron star, then I'm actually going to end up on this branch, the third family, not the neutron star branch. So that would be one scenario where this happens. And you know, and another important thing is that the configuration down here, just like the minimum mass of a neutron star, these are actually unstable configurations. So what happens if you're down here is not entirely clear. It hasn't been studied at all, to the best of my knowledge, at least. Okay, so of course, giving credit, essentially Glenn Denning and Kettner came up with this twin star phenomenon idea. But hybrid stars actually go as back as Gerlach, 1968, and that's the Gerlach from the Stern-Gerlach experiment.
Sorry. Yes. One more question about formation scenarios.
Yes.
So right, basically, if you want to have a hybrid twin star, then right, basically you need to get the central density above the phase transition.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yes.
It's a question of whether or not the central density is above or below.
Yes.
And so I guess if you think of a supernova formation or any type of formation where it's sort of violent, you'd expect central density during formation to be maybe even above the central equilibrium density.
It could be, yes.
So maybe only, you know, the only other way would be accretion or something more gradual and secular to raise the mass without raising the central density above the standard.
Sorry, it's not entirely clear to me. You're saying that in a supernova scenario, I cannot be above this?
No, I guess I'm trying to understand how you can form twin stars in two different ways. And
yeah, it may be the massive third family stars are easy if you're above the.
Yes, exactly.
But it's difficult to make low mass third family stars.
Oh, yeah. In that case, yeah, you probably need to perturb it somehow to actually just jump it, you know, across the other, you know, one thing could be essentially accretion. I don't know, another thing might be oscillations essentially after the supernova remnant. Maybe during the compression stage, you might actually go a little bit above this threshold. It's not clear to me, but certainly this is a completely open, you know, set of questions.
So if Lyell measures two 1.4 solar mass neutron stars with different radii, and then we're going to be scratching our heads as to how.
So I'm actually
how they actually got to these two families,
so,
as opposed to if we measure two.
But we're not going to be sensitive enough to tell the difference. That's the problem. So,
yeah.
You know, so this is exactly what we looked at with Kent and David Blaschke, Armin Sederkjan, and David Alvarez. So we computed the tidal deformability, just focusing entirely on gravitational waves, essentially, for the different configurations with these particular equations of state. So there's a range of equations of state. This is just showing two. So if you take, I mean, these two equations of state, but you focus essentially on the range of masses that are that the binary would be compatible, and you stay on the neutron star branch, essentially the tidal deformability for this particular equation of state turns out to be here, and then this is the lambda 2, lambda 1 plane, published essentially in the first LIGO paper, and these are the 50 and 90% contours for the tidal deformability planes. And so this is where the binary neutron star scenario with these kinds of equations of state without a phase transition essentially would be. But if you allow.
What is the difference between red and orange?
Sorry?
What is the difference in that line between red and orange?
Yeah, so red corresponds to just this particular equation of state. Orange corresponds to this equation of state.
Does the orange overlap the red? That's right.
In a particular regime, yes, because if you have you're actually below the phase transition threshold.
Right, so that continues. So I
see. Yeah, so the reason why it doesn't continue here is because these would be all unstable stars. Okay, so there's a certain.
Oh, I see. So both of them overlap on the right.
Exactly.
And then they jump to the.
Diagonal. And then you jump to this branch because you actually go to the second part, where you actually have one star on the hybrid branch, essentially. Not the twin stars, but essentially the hybrid branch. So it's about 1.6 solar masses. And so you have one hybrid star and one neutron star in this case. And so this is where you actually jump in that scenario. And so, you know, it seems that it's more consistent with this hybrid neutron star scenario, hybrid star neutron star scenario. But all I'm going to say essentially is that GW8-1708-17 cannot rule out the scenario. I'm not going to say that this is what explains, but it cannot rule it out as a potential.
Is it for a single equation of state? No.
No, this is for a particular equation of state that I'm showing here, just to make it clear, but we actually studied several equations of state.
So what is the degeneracy with US here?
So this is degeneracy.
Like, it's fairly universal, right? Is this the binary love relations?
No, it doesn't use any binary love relations, but. Interestingly, so one of the things we also did was to test the Isle of Q relations with these equations of state, and they're not violated. You're lucky, you know.
Thank you.
I'm saying you're lucky because I will show you in the next slide that they do violate another universal relation. So, okay.
So my question is, if you change the equation of state, instead of picking this one, you have picked a different one, you can probably move the lambda 2, lambda 1 curve around.
Yes, absolutely. I should point out that essentially we have two baseline hadronic equations of state onto which essentially we have this phase transition, and you could imagine that you have a larger range of hadronic equations of state where you have the phase transition essentially taking place, and yeah, you can certainly shift things quite a bit.
So I can cover an entire region.
In principle, yes.
Then you're not concluding
that. Well, you're concluding that you cannot rule it out.
Oh, I see.
I'm not.
It's just the same argument like you said earlier in the talk that you can't basically determine, you know,
precisely.
You can start a black hole.
Exactly.
The same thing.
Exactly.
Typically, you're most sensitive to the lower mass star, which is going to have the bigger lambda. And so now, if you're saying that the higher mass guy might be a little smaller than I thought and a smaller lambda, well that's fine. It's likely. It'd be very difficult.
And you know, let me just point out that these are not models that are, you know, they're parameterized models in the paper. However, the parameterizations that are involved can actually be derived with an actual effective field theory, a relativistic mean field theory. So it's not, you know, like completely, you know, bogus. Let's say just put an example out there, but they can be found essentially with some underlying assumptions.
Right. So the jump in the first order phase transition here is sort of fixed width.
We vary in several equations of state. Actually, we vary that as well. So.
Because if you vary that, you can easily make that discontinuity closer and closer to the red line.
Yeah, in principle, you can if you want to do, yes. But all we're saying essentially,
you cannot
rule it out. I'm not saying, you know, this is what happened. I'm just saying, you know, there's another possibility out there. Future observations might be able to tell if there's a difference, because if we had essentially two stars that are very close to the same mass, but we can actually have different radii, then something like this could be confirmed, though it would be very, very difficult. So given that these equations of state turn out to be essentially cannot be ruled out, so one of the things that we looked at with Gabriele and Pedro, who are here essentially, was that wanted to test how universal is this relation, because we found that these equations of state actually respect other universal relations, like the Isle of Q relations, but wanted to test if they actually can violate this. That the maximum mass of a maximally rotating neutron star is 20% larger than the non-rotating neutron star. And so this is the plot, which is the maximum mass on constant angular momentum sequences, essentially. So we create mass versus energy density. This would be the TOV star. Then we have a constant angular momentum sequence, another one, and another one, until you reach essentially the Kipper limit. And these configurations for each sequence are the so-called turning points, which define what is the maximum mass for a particular value of the angular momentum. And so this is what is plotted down here, is the angular momentum on a constant angular momentum mass, constant angular momentum sequence divided by the angular momentum, the supermassive limit. And here's how much more mass you can actually support for a given angular momentum. And so, if we focus on the last bit of this plot, essentially, this is the spread that we get with these kinds of equations of state. So in particular, what we find is that this ratio is not really 1.2, but it has more than a 10% spread, essentially, when you allow for these kinds of equations of state. So using a single value for this ratio essentially is not appropriate to place a constraint on the maximum mass of a neutron star or a compact star, I should say. Yes?
just a quick question. Is this a gravitational mass, right?
Not... Yeah, this is gravitational mass, yes. Okay. But it's very close to the rest mass. Sorry, yeah, the rest mass is very close to this as well.
I assume these have quite high binding energies, right? So it's...
If you focus on the ones that have that are more compact, yes, absolutely. Yes.
And the rapidly rotating one is a different phase than the maximum.
It is a hybrid star as well. The only cases were that we were able to actually have very large masses without having quark cores at all, as Pedro has done. Actually, he studied differentially rotating stars. But for uniformly rotating stars, we actually had quark cores as well.
Can I ask, what is the theory about when you merge the two neutrons? Say you have two stars which are normal hadronic, and then they merge and form an object which now wants to find this phase transition in the center. I mean, how long does it take for that transformation to have
the answer,
curving fronts that turn the matter into?
The answer that I would say I have for right now is that I have no idea, but I can you know, say a few things, is that these particular values apply essentially when you have zero temperature. So in the merger case, you're actually going to raise the temperature, and it's not clear to me what the transition density for a phase transition with finite temperature, how that changes. Maybe Chuck, you have something?
Yeah, so unless there's a big, weak quantum number like strangeness, the strong interactions are incredibly fast.
Okay, so it isn't high density. As I was aware of, these transformations, the strange, people talk about deflagration fronts turning the thing into a strange, but you're saying it's basically the instantaneous.
That's right.
I didn't realize your argument was about the time scale. So
sorry, I was misinterpreting. Because I remember these models of quark nova things where we take a finite amount of time to turn the object.
Okay. So, and at the very least, essentially, constraints of the maximum mass when you use these kinds of arguments do not apply to all nuclear physics models, essentially, that we have. So that's the takeaway message from this particular study. All right, so let's just go now over a few further challenges to existing constraints. And so here's a paper that essentially Ben mentioned a little bit earlier. So first question is prompt collapse really ruled out? In other words, does the total mass have to be less than this threshold mass for prompt collapse to a black hole? The main argument that was made essentially is that in all these scenarios, we don't really have a lot of matter ejected from these kinds of scenarios, so you wouldn't be able, at least from the quantity of mass that you have outside the black hole, you wouldn't be able to explain the electromagnetic signatures. So there was this paper that came out a couple of weeks ago, maybe, by Cucci et al., who studied irrotational binary neutron simulations, now changing to equal and unequal mass binaries. And they have a very strange way of what we would call prompt collapse. They actually don't use that. They call it a no bounds collapse. And because there are cases where they actually have collapse, which is on a dynamical time, but it undergoes a bounce before it actually collapses and forms a black hole. So they wanted to distinguish these two scenarios, one calling it no bounds, the other calling it a bounds collapse, and then they also introduced the short, which is survives for about 10, 20 milliseconds, essentially, and then long, which survives for much longer than this, essentially, than the simulations, the duration of the simulations.
Wait. So no bounds means it collapses?
No bounds means that it just merges and just so it's a, it's like it's a collapse.
And then short and long, it bounces.
What short would include also a bounce and a collapse, and a collapse within 10 to 20 milliseconds, essentially, which is what they simulated. Long would be longer than the simulation time span. So at least that's my understanding. So now what they did was to actually change the mass ratio. So they constructed several different equations of state. Here are the maximum masses of the equations of state they constructed. So they're all of order 2 solar masses, essentially. But the important thing is they used an equal mass and a mass ratio of 0.774, motivated by 1708-17. And here they list the tidal deformability for each case. The most important thing is that these things that I actually have, these particular lines that I've highlighted, essentially they have cases where you have an unequal mass ratio and you have no bounds and you have about 0.05 solar masses essentially left outside, and there's another case where you actually have 0.08 solar masses left outside the remnant, which is more than enough essentially to be able to explain, at least from the quantity of matter that you have outside, what you get. And in this scenario, you get about 1% of a solar mass ejected dynamically, and you have 0.06 solar masses of this material essentially staying around the black hole. Now, what I will agree with Ben on is that I think this points to an important, maybe, deficiency of the argument that essentially has been made by Bousmein et al. However, we certainly need to define what we mean prone collapse and what is no bounds collapse and all these things. And we need to be more careful, essentially, about all these statements, because they have profound impact on what constraints we will be able to place on the equations of state. So that's the takeaway message, at least from this slide. And in particular, ruling out prone collapse may not be that trivial. We just have to be a little bit more careful about this. Yes?
So how do they include thermal effects here, or do they include thermal effects?
These are gamma laws for the cold part, essentially. This is just, these are piecewise polytropic equations of state. So thermal effects are actually in a hybrid way. So this is the idea, essentially, for the, so it's not perfect. And that's another deficiency for this particular work. You're right. So we certainly need to do more simulations where we have realistic finite temperature equations of state and include different mass ratios to be able and have a proper definition of what we mean by prone collapse to be able to say definitively that we can rule out essentially this prone collapse scenario.
And in this case, neutrinos would matter, right?
Not in the prone collapse scenario, no.
In the long one or in the short
one? In those cases, yes. They, well, it depends on, what aspect. Within 10 to 20 milliseconds, they still are probably not going to matter. They don't have enough time to really, the neutrino time is of order a second.
Right.
So within 10, 20 milliseconds, it's not enough. So you need something to survive for much longer time. But the thermal physics is important. So in the same work, they also looked at this idea by Radice et al. That the tidal deformability has to be greater than 400 to be able to explain essentially the kilonova. How am I going with time? I think it's a...
We've interrupted you a lot, so
okay.
You can.
Okay. All right, so here essentially they have the same plot as Radice et al. This is the limit for what you want to be able to explain essentially with kilonovae. But now you can actually go to much lower. I should say that the error bars depend on essentially how much efficiency you're assuming, with how much efficiency you're going to be ejecting the disk matter outside the black hole that forms, whether it's going to be 10%, 20%, 100%. So that's what the error bars are, from 0 to 100% essentially in this plot. So if you allow 100% of the disk to be able to become unbound, essentially you can go as low as 250 roughly for the this binary tidal deformability. If you want essentially about 50%, then the limit goes to about 300. So, and when we get into that regime, essentially we don't really set a very strong constraint on this binary tidal deformability or on the radius of the neutron star.
But it's certainly a strong argument that it's non-zero.
Absolutely.
Better constraint on the lower end than the
Yes, that's true. Yes. So, but then, it's still going to be quite small. If you've set it, if you translate it to a radius constraint, it's going to be very, very small as a radius. So I don't remember the precise number, but it could be something like 8 kilometers or something like that.
So Radice had a constraint of greater than 400, and you're saying
it can be reduced to 300.
I think the real point is it's not just a constraint on lambda, it's a constraint on the combination of lambda and the maximum mass.
And the radius, yes.
I'm thinking lambda is a proxy for the radius.
Okay.
But I think you can't think of it as it's sort of a joint constraint. Like if we have a
better
constraint on POV mass, it would you could more precisely.
I agree.
Hold on. So, I mean, lambda depends on M1, M2, lambda 1, and lambda 2. But you could use the relationship between lambda 2 and lambda 1 to eliminate that, and then eliminate one of the two, and then you just have lambda tilde as a function of the two masses and just one of the two lambdas, the actual type.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what you mean. If you use the binary law of relations, essentially, you're saying.
Or you just use the relationship with dynamic language, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Because it's key to the six.
Oh, okay.
All right. So now, the next question is: how well is the total mass constrained? Oops, forgot an I here. From observations, essentially, of GW170817 from the gravitational waves. And it turns out that it depends very, very strongly on the spin priors. Not strongly, but, you know, it depends on the spin priors. So the range for the solar mass is between 2.7 and 3.3 solar masses, roughly, if you just focus on the gravitational waves alone. So any, essentially, constraint on the spin is basically there's no. So GW170817 did not constrain the spins at all of the neutron stars. And if you use the high mass end on this relation, any constraint on the maximum mass become very, very weak in that case. And that should have been on the next slide. So I should have said that the upper end here, the 3.3, actually applies to spin priors that go as high as 0.89. And Duncan explained to me yesterday why that's the case. I always was curious about why they chose 0.89. So you can ask Duncan if you're interested.
Well, the waveform calibration ends. You should have gone at the, if you're going to see that as a black hole, you should go to the wall. But the waveform that was used to do that only went up to
0.89.
Can you give us a sense of that there's a range in Mmax depending on the spin? So it's 2.7 if it's below 0.05.
Correct. Yes.
And then, you know, like.
Yeah, and 0.89 is outrageous, and actually that's what I'm going to say in the next slide. So 0.89 is really outrageous for if we assume that it was neutron stars, right? So if we had a black hole neutron star, then it's a different story. But staying within the rail...
Then you've got to calculate what it is if only one of the spin priors goes up to the one.
Yes.
This assumes that both spin priors... You have to do the calculation, which doesn't make sense.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Yeah. So we will... Yeah. We will let you know in 2 weeks. So here's a plot that was made by Gabriele last night, essentially. He ran these calculations to just find what is the maximum spin parameter, essentially is J over M squared versus the total mass, the mass of the configuration. And these are just several different equations of state, and just for this sample of equations of state, this J over M squared actually is between 0.63 and 0.77. So this was the thing that I was telling you yesterday, Duncan, that paper by the Chinese guys, They actually find almost a universal 0.7, but that's not true if you consider a different range of equations of state.
Okay.
It's actually, the spread is quite larger than that.
So LS220 can be quite a bit bigger than that.
Yes. Yes.
But again, this is maximum, like...
No. I'm not.
Who knows how it's spelled out?
No. The point that I'm trying to make here is completely different. Essentially, the upper end corresponds to 0.89, which is much larger than this. So what we really need to do, which is what Duncan actually started, we actually have to just set the spin prior to be actually motivated by what the maximum spin parameter can be from actual equations of state that we study. And then let's just see, do we really go as high up as 3.3 solar masses? Maybe the range actually is smaller. So this is more of a, I would say, you know, like criticism on the gravitational wave data analysis rather than,
yeah.
You know.
So I would even do something different, which is not just look at the maximum range, but also basically ask, I think what you were asking earlier, Brian, is that, you know, how far in close do you need to get to this 0.7 to get to that whatever 3.3 or 3. Whatever?
That's exactly the question we're after. Yes, that's
so
exactly.
So basically, I'm going to rerun the parameter estimation 10 times 0.1.2.
So the idea is to do it as a function of spin. And we also have essentially a spin parameter of 0.4 that Duncan's going to run, which corresponds to the fastest spinning star that we've ever observed, essentially. And so let's just see how that varies, essentially. And maybe it's not as severe, you know, as the 0.89 essentially. So that's the basic idea here.
So if you have a neutron star spinning this fast,
yes,
how long does it stay spinning that fast?
Well, if it's magnetic
forever,
zero, then
forever. So in the astronomy community, there's a very interesting saying: once a millisecond pulsar, always a millisecond pulsar. The reason is that millisecond pulsars have tiny magnetic fields, so they actually, the spin down time is of order of the Hubble time, essentially.
And we also have these R mode instabilities, which say that even millisecond pulsars shouldn't exist.
That's essentially setting a lower limit, which is it's actually pretty high. So I don't remember what the corresponding spin parameter is for that, but the spin period is actually very, very small if you just take that. Let alone that we don't even know where the R mode instability saturates. So
but certainly there's a prejudice that if you really did have neutron stars that could spin this fast and they stay spinning this fast.
Yes.
Then we might have seen it.
But and again, you know, this will be a prejudice based on what we've observed essentially in our galaxy, that all millisecond pulsars spin down very, very, very slowly.
If all of the LIGO ones are spinning this, I mean, at some point, you know, I'll give you one or give you a few, but like, you know, at some point they have to start to look like ones at some level, right? So I think we have to put together multiple events.
Yeah, exactly. We need a population. We need populations. I agree.
And you know, this, you can also do interesting stuff because in Shomi's paper, you know, LIGO always uses the uniform mass price between 1 and 0. But we know that galactic neutron stars are very narrowly peaked around 1.37 solar masses. And if you do that, you get a different posterior on the mass ratio, which would then inform, so you know, it's all Bayesian, right? So tell me what your belief is going in, and I'll tell you what the posteriors are coming out. And that would give you a different constraint on the upper.
When we're off the record, you know, when I'm not actually being recorded, I'll just tell you something that Nico has said about these things in the past.
So just for reference,
yes.
Do we know what the ballpark value of spin is for the fastest known ballpark?
That's about 0.4.
About 0.4.
It depends on the equation of state, of course.
I just want to point out that the chirp mass of 1797 is right in the middle of the galactic distribution of chirp masses, so that would say that it smells like just a normal planet.
Yeah, but
it smells like
that
a
doesn't
member of the galactic.
While I agree with you, it's actually there is an assumption that is made for sure.
I'm just saying that if I had to bet.
I don't know. I don't like to bet. I don't like to gamble. So. All right, so neutron star spins can be up to roughly, let's say, 0.77. But there are calculations, numerical activity calculations underway that do include the binary, the spin of the neutron stars. So in a recent work with my collaborators at the University of Illinois, we actually looked at spins of order 0.2 to 0.3, including magnetic fields in a scenario that has delayed collapse. So you will actually allow the magnetic field to essentially expand the disk. And in those cases, we actually find that if we have high spins and magnetic fields, you can increase essentially the disk mass outside the random black hole by almost a factor of 5 compared to the non-spinning case. So arguments, you know, of the form essentially you don't have enough matter, maybe when you add spin actually can change significantly when you have spin and magnetic fields involved. In hypersimulations, this is work in preparation with Will East, Franz Pretorius, and Antonis Tsokaros. We're actually just focusing on one equation of state and just do a little bit more careful study of spins. We have counter-rotating spins, non-spinning. These are two different ways of building a spin of 0.17, 0.25, and 0.33 for the spins. And if we allow up to a spin of 0.3, essentially compared to the irrotational case, this is the disk mass in percent of solar mass. Essentially, so we find that for the highest spin cases that we actually are looking at, we can double pretty much the amount of disk mass that is outside the black hole in all these scenarios.
So you have 1 minute left.
Yes. All right, so the increased disk mass in these binary neutron star simulations essentially with increasing spin is likely to lower the bound on the tidal deformability essentially that people have found even further just based on the same arguments that people have been making. Now, in relation to this threshold mass compared to the maximum mass of a TOV star, it has to depend on the pre-merger neutron star spins because it's a threshold quantity. So even a small amount of spin can change this threshold quantity. All right, so since it's only 1 minute, right on time, takeaway message. Existing constraints on the equation of state from 1708-17 make a number of plausible assumptions. I'm not going to deny that they're plausible. They are assumptions, however. 1708-17 could be a black hole neutron star. We cannot rule it out. If we assume a binary neutron star, the fate of the remnant is not 100% certain at this time. So making all these arguments about that's the fate of the remnant, so that's the constraint that we can settle the equation of state, is not 100% certain. And the methods we developed for constraining the US in the binary neutron star scenario, I'll just say they're brilliant. I love them. They're all wonderful. Whatever Brian and Ben have done, Tsokaros et al. And Rizzola, I think they're all, and Bauswein, I think they're very, very nice ideas, wonderful. But I would say the existing equation of states constraints are weak. That's my takeaway message.
Great.